Hi, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of the Comedy Podcast. I'm your host, Subi Sade. On this episode, I was joined by Naveen Agarwal, who's the founder of Creative Analytics Solutions and host of Let's Talk Risk. In this episode, Naveen walks through the big changes to risk management with regards to QMSR. He talks about risk beyond safety. This episode also covers the confusion surrounding the mandatory nature of risk management in particular, and we spend the second half of the episode talking about risk acceptability charts, risk and quality policy, explaining versus justifying risk-based decision-making with regards to the red, yellow, green charts that most companies use for risk acceptance. If you're not already subscribed to the show, please subscribe on whatever platform you're listening on. And with that, here is my friend Naveen.
Hello, Combi Nation. My name is Subi Sade. I've spent over a decade in medical device, pharma, and combination product development. Our industry feels complicated sometimes. Drugs, devices, clinical trials, submissions, sterilization, validation, design control, risk management, market access, reimbursement. The list goes on. My goal is mastery. So this podcast is to ask questions I have to people who may have the answers. Each week on the Combinate Podcast, I talk to someone about their area to further understand and simplify. Whether you're a pharma person trying to understand the next wave of products, or a device person trying to navigate a pharma system you're unfamiliar with, or a newbie in both areas, I invite you to listen, and together we can simplify by combinating.
The one thing that was puzzling for me was really focused on 14971. And I was just thinking as I was reading some of the comments, surely if we're going to be adopting and harmonizing against 13485, there would be a formal harmonization adoption against 14971. But that's not what the QMSR said, or that's not what I perceived it to say. And so I'm just a little confused by that. And yeah. I wanted you to maybe explain to me from your perspective, what is the QMSR saying? What does it mean?
That's a perfect question. A lot of confusion about this. ISO 13485 itself does not mandate ISO 14971. It does not mandate. Keep in mind that ISO 13485 is an international standard, and any ISO standard is not a mandatory requirement, except in case of ISO 13485, where it is used for regulatory purposes. The title itself says it can be used for regulatory purposes, which means a regulatory body can require people to comply with ISO 13485. Having said that, in ISO 13485 content, the normative side of ISO 13485, there is no mandatory requirement of ISO 14971. They talk about risk, and they talk about risk in a slightly broader way than 14971. So that's one point to think about, right? 14971 is primarily a safety risk management standard in a practical way. So I don't want to get hung up on the regulatory language. Understanding 14971 is basically from a safety perspective. 13485 considers risk beyond just safety. They are also talking about safety and performance and compliance with applicable regulatory requirements. So that's the context of risk, which means, in principle, 14971 cannot satisfy everything that 13485 requires for risk management. So that's why they don't mandate it.
But why?
Now, having said that, okay, go ahead.
I was just going to say, fine, but we are still required to manage the safety risk. And one could argue that, yes, while managing business risk and process risk and so on and so forth, sources of variability that come with all those things, the safety risk is still probably the most important bit.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
So why not mandate that?
So why that's not a question for
the... You know what I mean? So I know you're not a regulator, sure, right? And so, but why, practically speaking, everybody's using it?
It's true. So this is a question for the ISO committees. These are different ISO committees. And they have not come to sort of a common consensus on this, which means it has been left out from the standard as a mandatory requirement. Now, having said that, 14971 is the best thing that we have today. It's years of work. A lot of knowledge and expertise has gone into building 14971. So some might call it the state-of-the-art practice of medical device risk management. Some might call it, right? So the reason why we want to do it, in my view, is because it's the right thing to do, not because it is mandatory.
Yeah, and I think the point that you bring up is a good one. And FDA and a lot of the comments that they were responding to were applying this principle of we're not going to overshoot beyond what's in the standard. We're harmonizing against the standard. And so, yeah, I didn't think of the fact that 1345 not referencing 14971 being probably the reason. And so what you're saying is...
Let me clarify that. It does reference 14971, but
mandate
in a note.
Yeah, it doesn't mandate it.
In a note. It doesn't mandate it.
But even the QMSR, I believe it says that the notes are not... I think there was a comment on that, that we're harmonizing against the actual sections, not all of the footnotes in particular.
Correct. And having said that, the notes are important because that gives you an idea about what would be expected, how would that requirement be interpreted, and how you would be required to show compliance. So you need to understand the notes, but no one can say, hey, this note says like this and you didn't follow it, so you are out of compliance. No, we cannot say that.
Now, what are your initial reactions to the QMSR final rule?
Well, to be honest with you, you are right that many of the big companies will not have a lot of challenge, and most of the benefits of QMSR transition will be realized by big companies. So FDA has come out with some cost-benefit analysis. They are required to do it by law, right? So they are projecting savings of about $530 million, right, after incurring some costs. Most of it will be realized by big companies because they have redundant systems. So my take on this is, and this kind of relates to my sentiments for the small companies, is they are going to get in a little bit of a problem with this. They're going to have to bear the cost, which FDA estimates on average will be like $2,000. Much. But $2,000 also for a 5% company is a big amount of money, right? And average doesn't mean anything. So to be honest with you, my take on this is really the small to mid-sized companies are going to have a little bit of an uphill climb, particularly if they are not used to doing business in a regulatory jurisdiction where ISO 13485 is the norm. So they'll have a bigger hill to climb. However, the large companies are also not out of the woods. I think on paper, it seems very simple. But when you actually try to integrate and practice, the devil is in the details. So on paper, it sounds like not a big deal. And I think that's how FDA is pitching it.
Ooh. Particularly related to risk management. Is anything changing?
It is changing a lot. A lot. Not in philosophy. Because FDA's philosophy and mindset was explained very well in the preamble to QSR. So not in the mindset and philosophy, but in requirements. Explicit requirements, a lot is changing. Because risk is explicitly mentioned in multiple places in ISO 13485 as a mandatory requirement. Now, how you do it is up to you. You don't have to follow 14971. How you do it is up to you. But now you cannot just say, hey, I didn't do risk analysis in my design validation part for software. That's where you can catch me. That's how it was in part 82030G, right? But now they can catch you in many other places if you don't do risk management right.
Can you elaborate on that in terms
so
of
let's
the...
Take a,
yeah, I think I'm hearing what you're saying. You're saying that they, just going back to what we were talking about earlier, 14971 is not mandated by 13485, therefore it's not mandated by the QMSR. However,
correct.
13485 has risk management sprinkled in all throughout where the QSR historically has not.
Nope.
And so... You know, when they're looking at a product's risk management file, the philosophy is probably going to be the same. However, when you talk about the risk management that's expected in 1345 for everything other than design and development planning, or for other than design and development, that's where the shift in the thinking is happening?
Well, let me give you a very specific example where even in design and development, this could be a point of discussion and inquiry, right? ISO 13485 clearly says that the outputs of risk management should flow into the inputs to design and development.
Yeah, right.
Correct?
Correct.
It's not mandated by the current quality system regulation, but in future, we would need to examine how you have created that link between risk management and your design control. How have you done that? Show me an example of what kind of outputs are flowing into your design inputs and what kind of outputs are flowing from your design control process back into the risk management process. That will be actually quite important now for manufacturers to practice and clearly demonstrate.
Is that because your expertise is really in risk management and you've dealt with a lot of different kinds of products? While not specifically mentioned in the QSR beyond that part of, I think you said it was 820.30G, just the risk management, yep. That sentence that's in design controls.
Just risk analysis. They don't even say risk management.
Oh, risk analysis. Risk analysis. Okay. Practically speaking, though, has the FDA been already applying that?
Yes, in a roundabout way.
Yeah.
So if you read FDA's warning letters, they will cite you against the requirement in QSR. That will be the top line. If you read any of the observation, the way they write is very, very insightful. Read any of the observation. They'll cite you against a particular requirement in the QSR. But if you read their description and the evidence that they are sharing with you, they're all based on risk management deficiencies. Mm. In a majority of cases, they might cite you against CAPA, they might cite you against complaints handling procedure, they might cite you against MDR reporting, but the foundation of their observation is rooted in their sort of disagreement with how you are practicing risk management.
I believe in future,
they'll start writing explicitly where you are deficient in your risk management practices because now they have the leverage.
They have more things to pluck at now, whereas before.
Well, it's stated. Exactly. Yeah. If it says you will use a risk-based approach to select suppliers, qualify suppliers, and re-qualify suppliers, well, let me see how you have done that. If not, you are out of compliance.
Are there any findings that come to mind related to what you just described?
As a matter of fact, actually, I have written a couple of case studies on FDA warning letters, particularly around post-market side, which has been like an area of focus for me. One of the requirements of 14971 is that in the post-market phase, production or post-production phase, you will monitor. You will actively gather, review safety-related information from a variety of sources. And then you will take action. Well, what is one of the key thing that we are trying to detect is, has the risk changed in any way? That we estimated a certain level and we found that acceptable. And we are talking about an individual risk. Has that changed? And have you taken appropriate action? And in fact, in several warning letters I wrote about in case studies, FDA pointed precisely to that you are not calculating your risk correctly in the post-market phase. As a result, you cannot detect a change in the risk level. As a result, you're not taking the right action. But they cannot really cite you against that. They cite you against certain, your complaints handling procedure is not adequate or your CAPA procedure is not adequate. That sends a wrong signal because then people say, let me go fix my CAPA procedure. Because they don't read the evidence. They say, okay, we are all fine. We are not required to do that, maybe, right? Let me go fix my CAPA procedure and put more requirements. Well, that's not the answer. The answer is, do we have the right practices in place about estimating risk? Do we have the right data sources in place to review and re-estimate risk? Do we have the right decision-making process for risk acceptability? Are they actionable enough? Or they are vague and ambiguous, so no one can decide whether something has changed beyond acceptability level or not. So you'll have to start thinking about the practical side of this. I think that's where I want to go.
In terms of some of the clients that you've worked with, have you been in situations where there was an audit or an inspection finding like that where you had to invite them to read between the lines and pay attention to, well, it's not really the the SOP that needs to be fixed, but what's underpinning it, the decision making you mentioned, the roles and responsibilities, the, you know, those kinds of things?
So I haven't done that on a personal level. I haven't done that work with specific clients. I have basically been in a space which has been relatively mature from a risk management point of view.
Oh,
and
is that
help
right?
them actually, be, yeah, and help them even become more efficient. But reading through these warning letters has given me this insight that this is a widespread problem. Even in very mature organizations, it's a widespread problem. I'll give you an example, a little bit more specific example. You have two groups. You have quality group, and let's say you have medical safety group, which is responsible for doing health hazard evaluations. For health hazard evaluations, they need to be able to evaluate and estimate and evaluate risk, right? Quality people need to do that through design and development to set the stage right and maybe, you know, review their post-market data. In one warning letter, they mention these two groups are using two different tables.
Oh.
Two different tables in a very mature organization. They are calculating their probability incorrectly. So, Subi,
incorrectly
I have not been
or incorrectly or inconsistently?
No, actually, FDA writes, we do not agree with your method of calculation of probability of occurrence.
Interesting. Well, can double-click on that. What? Interesting. Why? Were they
yes.
undershooting?
So there are many problems. The first problem I mentioned was people are using different tables, right? So they assign a different ranking, for example, to probability or severity, and they come out with a wrong number. The other problem I have seen is a very simple math problem, right? You need a numerator and a denominator to estimate probability.
Right.
Right. Now, denominator people tend to use something like units shipped or quantities sold or procedures performed.
Cool.
FDA has come back and challenged mature organizations on their denominator. They are saying you are underestimating it because much of the product is on the shelf. It's not being used. You need to use the denominator, which is actually in use, which is much lower than what you have shipped. So as a result, your probability estimate is incorrect.
How do they know that? Like particularly, let's say for something like a disposable, it's going to, I mean, there are a lot of drugs, for example, that are on shortage. So let's say something like a prefilled syringe for a generic drug. In many cases, the demand outweighs the supply.
Yes.
And so how does that, I can see the point of like, well, if you're accounting for everything that you've made and half of it is sitting in your warehouse, then, you know, the probability of occurrence should be based on what is available for use, not what mm-hmm. is sitting in your warehouse. I can understand
right.
that. But how have you seen that practically changed? Because you'd have to do a lot of work around the material
yes.
management space to get that down.
Well, I think one of the key takeaway message here is FDA is using that as an evidence for citing you against a certain requirement. Now, they have come to that conclusion based on their inspection, their findings, right? They can sit for many, many weeks if they need to. Look at any of your data, any of your information, and they can do their own calculations to come to that. It doesn't mean that it is applicable to everybody. It is applicable in that case. It reflects the FDA's approach and the rigor that they are able to exercise during investigations to come to generate evidence for their finding, right?
Sure.
That's the point I'm trying to make.
So what you're saying is in those instances where they're citing inconsistencies or disagreement with how calculations are being handled, it's probably because there was some reaction response that would have been appropriate.
That's
that
correct.
that was either not done
taken.
Or not done enough. Okay.
That's correct.
Yeah. Interesting.
So we need to keep the big picture in mind is that if we are not estimating the uncertainty, let's talk about big picture. Nothing is perfect, right? There's uncertainty in every estimate. And if that uncertainty is not properly characterized and understood, and that affects our decisions, which affect the safety and effectiveness of product in the field, we are going to get cited, no doubt. And now
yeah.
they will have a little bit more leverage to cite you more explicitly about where you are doing it incorrectly than before.
I recently had on former FDA inspector, and I was asking him about inspection readiness. I posted the clip on my LinkedIn, and he was just saying that the inspection readiness that he's seen is less focused on compliance and more focused on quality and presenting the quality that's being done.
Yeah.
That's kind of related to what you're talking about. That
absolutely.
Those situations where folks are being cited on a very specific section are probably related to background, that something wasn't done that should have been done, etc.
That's
quality
absolutely
thing,
right.
not a compliance checkbox. This element wasn't done. It's more like there was a disconnect that actually caused something meaningful to occur.
That is absolutely right. And I think this is one area where, if you are a large, mature organization or global company, expectations are higher. You are practicing 13485 for a long time. You must know process-based quality system. You must be able to find relationships between processes, what flows in, what flows out. You must be able to control these processes and manage these processes. So you're going to be held at a higher bar compared to someone who doesn't have that experience. And these examples I gave you are actually coming from pretty mature organizations where you would expect people to be able to say, hey, how we do our calculations here may affect the decisions that affect the safety and effectiveness of our product in the field. They are not able to connect the dots. So having a process approach is going to be, I think, a little bit of an uphill battle for even very mature organizations, because we are used to doing things in a certain way.
I'm going to ask you a question. I can cut this out if you don't like the question, but why do you find that you work with more mature organizations versus less mature?
Oh, so that has just been my history. I don't have to cut anything, but does it? So I came from large multinational organizations. I had 10 years at J&J. And when I started my consulting practice, I did actually a project for J&J. They were in an acquisition situation. I helped them integrate the two different risk management systems. Two very different risk management systems. And that took a couple of years. And I really didn't do a whole lot of projects with many other firms. I did a couple of sort of audits here and there. I did have one audit where, to be honest with you, I think I helped them see through there. This was an internal audit. So this was not like, you know, notified body or anything like that. I helped them see through the deficiencies in their complaints handling process, which I just was talking about. So my work mostly has concentrated on big clients or big companies because that's how it went. But my work on Let's Talk Risk over the last 2 years, through studying and through developing case studies and through talking to people, has given me this background and understanding that this is where most people are going to struggle. And, you know, I don't have to be physically present to see it, right? I can see it in the world by talking to people and by reading about it. So I hope that makes sense to you.
It does. Yeah. No,
right?
You can
edit it if you want.
Sure. Okay. So any final thoughts on the QMSR, particularly as it relates to risk management?
I think my final thoughts here would be take a good look at your practices. Develop a process-based approach to find where you have gaps in controlling those processes, whether they're on the input side, on the output side, whether it's on the personnel side. You look at each process distinctly and think of risk in a bigger from a bigger point of view. Just like we would set up a manufacturing operation, highly automated manufacturing operation, which has different cells, and each cell is responsible for producing a certain output, same principle should apply to quality systems, quality management systems. And then that'll inform you where you need to improve your risk management practices. I won't start with 14971 to come down and come downward. I won't start with 13485 and come down. I would start with following our own processes, mapping them out, building relationships, and identifying gaps. Do we know what to measure for each process? If not, how can we control it? How can we manage it? So that's a place to start. So I would emphasize that don't look at QMSR as a compliance problem to deal with in the next 2 years. Look at QMSR as an opportunity to fundamentally upgrade your practices.
You're updating.
That would be my takeaway message.
you're updating them anyways, potentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, switching gears into a couple of more risk focused topics, I wanted to talk about risk policy and risk acceptability charts. Can you just walk through conceptually what those mean for the folks that are not familiar?
Sure thing. So let's start with risk acceptability first, right? 14971 requires top management to establish a policy for establishing criteria for risk acceptability. So it's kind of a mouthful. Basically, what they are saying is, since 14971 does not require a quality management system in place, we are assigning this responsibility to top management. If you have a quality management system already in place, you are probably already doing that as part of your quality policy. So that's a key point to understand. 14971 does not say you must have a standalone risk acceptability policy, but you must have a framework to help people make the right decisions about what kind of risk level is acceptable or not. It's a framework, not a mandatory specific sort of table that top management should kind of announce and bring it down, right? So what 14971 is saying is that establish a risk policy. They are not saying establish a quality policy because it's not a quality system standard. You see, this is where you have to understand the limitations of 14971. If you are operating under 13485 model and you say, I want to just borrow 14971, you might make the wrong call of saying, I need a standalone risk acceptability policy. Not true. What I advise people, review your quality policy. You have one. And 90% of that meets the criteria of risk policy that is kind of suggested by 14971. So if you look at the guidance ISO TR 24971, there's a full annex about how to do this. And in that annex, you will find criteria for what this policy should be based on and what it should include. And if you look at your quality policy, I guarantee you that 90% of elements that you need to have in a risk policy, you already have them in your quality policy. So just find what is missing from your quality policy from a risk management point of view and include that. That's it. One simple statement can help you. And that simple statement generally, Subi, relates to, in my experience, approach to risk control. That's the only element which is not explicitly stated in most cases from quality policies. In my ISO 14971 training, Subi, I actually give people an example of a quality policy that can be just tweaked very slightly to meet the requirements of the risk acceptability policy under 14971. Does that make sense?
It's one of those situations where it's like it kind of feels obvious. I don't know why nobody has. It's something that I never thought of before that feels obvious, where I almost feel dumb for not thinking that in the past.
No,
I'm not being self-deprecating here. I'm just saying, like, it makes so much sense, is what I was trying to say. But the question that I have is, do you still call it a quality policy, or do you still call it like a quality and risk policy?
No, just call it a quality policy. Because the claim we are going to make is, Mr. Auditor, we are not required to do risk management separately from our quality system. Don't ask us to show you a standalone risk policy because we are not required to do so. We choose to integrate our quality policy to manage risk across the board because that's what 13485 wants us to do.
But would you say like calling it quality and risk management policy or something like that would be better? Or?
No, I don't. That's not how I would do it, but there's no harm in doing that way. Subi, I don't want people to think of risk separate from quality.
Yeah.
I want them to think quality because that's what matters. Risk is important because we want to ensure quality. So I'm not in favor of these qualifiers like risk management being something separate, quality risk management or safety risk management. To me, we need to meet the needs of our customers and keep them safe and effective. How we do it is up to us.
How does risk acceptability play into the risk policy?
Yes. So let's talk about a little bit more tactical side of it, right? The policy should allow you to make decisions whether each individual risk is acceptable or not. And it should also allow you to make decisions whether overall residual risk is acceptable or not. So the policy should allow you to make those decisions. It doesn't mean that the policy prescribes how to make those decisions, but gives you a framework. So a simple framework, just for example only, it doesn't apply to everybody. A simple framework could be, you know, our policy is to reduce risk to as far as possible without adversely affecting the benefit risk ratio. This is our policy. So you might ask, okay, how would you know that you have reduced risk to as far as possible? How? Right? What criteria would you use? I would say that's the job of my risk team or quality team to work together to establish that specific set of criteria in a risk management plan. So now let's talk about how you might want to do that. We are all very familiar with a risk matrix. Let's say a 5x5 risk matrix. You have severity on the top. You have probability on the rows. Severity, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Probability, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But in case of probability, you may give ranges. What does 1 mean? What does 2 mean? What does 3 mean? You may give those ranges. And those ranges is where you claim that the ranges are specified to align with our policy framework. And these ranges are different for different products because what is as far as possible for one product is not the same as what is as far as possible for another product. So by doing so, I give myself the freedom and flexibility to prescribe specific criteria in my risk management plan for a specific product within the framework of my overall policy. Does that make sense?
It does. It just diving deep into one thing that you mentioned, for EU, the as far as possible is mandated, right? Is anything changing related to that in the US? Because there's as far as possible, ALARP and ALARA.
Yeah. So these are approaches to risk control.
Yeah. But that was the part that you said that is missing from the risk policy, right? From the quality policy typically.
Yes. Risk control. So what is missing is the approach to risk control. Yeah. And how you don't have to do AFAP. You don't have to do ALARA. You don't have to do ALARP. But whatever you decide to do, you must write it down. What is your approach to risk? When do you stop risk control? When do you stop? And how do you make that determination? You should write about it. So you are right. On EUMDR, they write, risk should be reduced to as far as possible without affecting benefit risk ratio. But they're also, Subi, I don't want to get into too many weeds there, but they're not saying that every single individual risk should be done that way. You may apply different approaches to individual risks, but in totality, what they are saying in totality, it should be such that the overall residual risk is as far as possible. Does that make sense? So we don't want to get hung up on what they have written in the annex.
Keep going on that. It doesn't make.
So
when it comes to residual risk, the risk control measure is mitigating against whatever your perceived risk is going to be, and the residual risk is the post mitigation once you have somewhat of an understanding of how your control is performing. How do you, like in a risk management summary report, or if you separate out the risk benefit analysis somewhere, you're documenting for those marginal risks, they're typically called, however much you've controlled it, it is as far as possible. And so how do you do that in the collective but not necessarily in the individual? That didn't click for me.
Okay, so as far as possible is not a quantitative measure, first of all. No one has defined that. It's not a goalpost. It's not like running 26.2 miles in a marathon.
Yeah.
Right? Nobody can say, you know, you're a good runner if you can say as long as you can last. And that depends on every runner. Every runner, as far as possible, could be judged differently. And again, having said, I'm not a regulatory guy, okay? So this is my read, is what EUMDR and even FDA would expect us to do to demonstrate our product is safe and effective, is that if we are demonstrating that our overall residual risk is the best it could be in the context of the benefits that we are offering. It is sort of a, you know, semi-quantitative analysis. And I've addressed that. So I'm talking about the overall level first so that people are clear on it. Yeah. It is not counting beans. We are not being bean counters. We are not being accountants. We are taking the whole picture in view, and FDA has provided us a beautiful guidance, a worksheet in that guidance, which I went through actually step by step in a recent webinar with my colleagues. I wrote an article about that too.
What guidance is it?
It's a guidance for benefit risk considerations for pre-market approvals and de novos. Factors to consider for benefit risk determinations for pre-market approvals and de novos. It's actually a guidance document that provides a worksheet and a checklist to answer the questions. Are the benefits of the intended use? Are there any benefits? What is the uncertainty of benefits? Are there any risks which are more than just sort of minimal? What is the uncertainty in risk? And what's the benefit risk? So they've given you a framework and checklist that you can use with data, with analysis, with subject matter opinion, particularly clinical judgment, to document why you claim that the benefit risk is as far as possible, right? So that's a different conversation.
Is this a new guidance?
2019, I believe it was issued in 2019. It's a final document. It is there that I see no reason why we should not be practicing that, even though we may be talking about a 510K. I mean, I'm not talking about regulatory submission.
Yeah.
You may choose not to do it, but there's no reason why you wouldn't want to follow that model to practice in your risk management process.
Yeah.
Very prescriptive.
If I had a nickel for every time I said I'm not a regulatory guy, I'm in the same boat as you, Naveen. I completely agree. And so what you're saying is that just because you're not doing a de novo submission or a PMA doesn't necessarily discount the fact that it's still a good tool.
No, it's a great tool.
Get your benefit risk.
It's a great tool. Actually, I was so amazed by it. I took the opportunity to actually do a case study of an artificial intelligence-based device that was recently cleared. I got publicly available information, and I reverse-engineered the worksheet for this device. Mm. And it wasn't that difficult. It just took me a couple of days. You can sit down and just do the practice and then start applying to your device for which you already have a lot of information. And if you do this early on, Subi, the advantage you will have is that you can plan your clinical evaluations or clinical investigations later on. You can plan your design and development process. You can plan where you will make the trade-offs. So that's the overall benefit risk side. Let me talk about the individual residual risk side, right?
Yep.
According to 14971, we have to identify all individual risks, all, no exception, related to hazards and hazardous situations associated with our product. And each one of those individual risks should meet our criteria of acceptability to be demonstrated as acceptable or not. And then it becomes a residual risk. There we have a little bit of flexibility in defining what we mean by as far as possible for those individual residual risks. There's no goalpost. I mean, if I have a state-of-the-art product safety standard that applies to some of those individual risks, I must follow that, and that's as far as possible. If those standards are prescriptive enough to tell me what to test, what should be my acceptance criteria, what should be my sampling, if I do all that, and I pass those acceptance criteria, if I pass those, I can claim as far as possible for those individual residual risks. For other ones, I don't have any state-of-the-art or product safety standards. I need to define on my own what I mean. And for that, I need to survey. For example, sterilization. What is the current standard for sterilization? SAL of 10 to the minus 6, right? Mm-hmm. So very crystal clear. I must demonstrate with confidence that I can deliver 10 to the minus 6 SAL. Very simple. That's as far as possible. I could do 10 to the minus 8, right? Doesn't mean 10 to the minus 6 is not acceptable. 10 to the minus 8 is better. I may claim That's why my product is superior, because my infection rates are much, much lower than everybody else. I have the choice to do that. On the other hand, let's say biocompatibility or toxicity. I get 10993. I have some guidance there. I can select which test methods to do, but I don't have explicit acceptance criteria. I need to look up, like, what is a similar product in the marketplace which is currently performing at a certain level? What is acceptable? The lab that is going to do the testing for me, do they have a well-established method which is sort of industry-wide accepted? So I have to do a little bit more work, and that is where I could define what as far as possible mean for each individual residual risk in a slightly different way. I could. I hope that illustrates the difference.
And so what about the risk acceptability charts then?
Okay.
How do so, those, because I completely understand that is the state of the art element. And so if there's a standard method, for example, or a standard expectation that is typically expected, so-and-so particles is below a certain threshold. And, you know, you mentioned sterility assurance level. That's another really good one. Forces are, in some cases, specified, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there is risk acceptability chart. There's that. And I kind of wish that they did it in red, yellow, green in the 24971 standard. They did like different shades of gray and black, which in my opinion are a little harder to read. But where do those generic acceptability charts come in then?
So you will have a risk matrix, mm-hmm. right? Generally speaking, 5x5 is commonly practiced. You don't have to have a 5x5 risk matrix. Yeah. It could be 3x5, it could be 4x4, but 5x5 is the general practice. Now, I'm not a big fan of red, yellow, green. I want only red or green. Yeah, I don't like red, yellow, green. It either is acceptable or not. There is no middle ground. Because
yellow is acceptable with justification.
No, I don't believe that. Either is acceptable or not acceptable. That's the way I practice. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but that's my practice. It keeps things very clear.
But as far as you're talking about as far as the actual matrix is concerned. And so let's say for example you have an S4 probability of, or an S5 probability of 1. S5 probability of harm of 1. I've typically not seen those set as green, even you know what I mean? Because they're just high severity. And so you may say we've applied enough controls, therefore we're going to accept this marginal risk. But I think maybe what is your perspective, that that's just a thought exercise and it is actually acceptable?
So let's walk that example. Severity of 5, probability of 1. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to make a policy that no matter what the probability is, no matter whether it's 10 to the minus 9 or 10 to the minus 12, we would still consider that.
One in a billion.
Let's say it's 1 in a billion. You would say my 1, probability level 1, is less than 1 in a billion. And for S5, I would not consider that to be acceptable because severity is what I count. Severity is what I consider as the only determining factor for risk, for that severity. You could do that. Nobody is saying you can't. And you could choose to continue with that relative or supposedly unacceptable individual risk and then see if that overwhelmingly impacts your overall benefit risk or not. If that tilts the favor against you, then you can't go to market. There is no justification anymore.
Okay, so that goes back to the wider point that you were making earlier. In my head, I feel like it's the same thing. That either way, you're still looking at the overall benefit and the overall risk at some point.
That's correct.
It's just you're saying that for. Isn't it part of 14971 that you're not proceeding with unacceptable risk? And so,
there is a little bit of, I think there's a little bit of ambiguity there, because what ISO 14971 says is that you can proceed with an otherwise unacceptable individual residual risk. So play out one individual risk that you find unacceptable. You can do the benefit risk analysis for that individual risk, not the overall. Okay? Are you tracking with
me? But that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that let's say I'm trying to think of one S5P1 where you would say the benefit essentially outweighs this risk. We've controlled it as far as possible. We're still considering it yellow just because of the high severity, and there's no situation where this would be considered unacceptable. There's no situation where we would accept it without justification.
So I think what we are saying is in a way similar things. What you are saying, your justification really is grounded in benefit risk for that individual risk.
Yeah.
I'm not using the word justification at all because I don't want any justifications. What I want is a clear line. It's not acceptable, but it doesn't overwhelmingly negatively impact my overall benefit risk. That's clinical argument I want to make. So this language of justification,
okay,
is sort of not it doesn't resonate with me.
I understand. So what you're kind of getting at is you're writing down your thinking, but it's not like it's not that this would be inappropriate without, you know, these few sentences. It's that for this product, it is appropriate, and I'm just providing the rationale for
because
for
what
how,
I'm saying
for how it's green. You're saying it's actually green. It's not yellow.
Yes, actually, I preach S5P1 is green. Depends upon what one is, because nothing can be zero. The probability cannot be zero. If you demand zero, I should close my shop and go away. I should not be in the market.
We'll have to do a more deep dive with practical examples of this.
Yep.
I think I understand what you're saying. I think I struggle with, you know, just a risk acceptability chart that's green and red. But you know, we'll hopefully
we'll table that for another day.
Yeah.
Another day.
Where can people find you, Naveen?
So people can find me on Let's Talk Risk, which is my Substack website. That's the best place to connect with me. You know, I invite people to be part of our Let's Talk Risk community. I'm very active on LinkedIn. Every Friday, Subi, at 11 a.m. Eastern, I do a live audio event. Everybody is welcome to join those audio sessions and become part of the whole risk management community that we are trying to build, where we can have these ongoing conversations. As we have seen, these are sort of difficult, thorny issues. And it's only through conversations that we can learn from each other to figure out how best to practice in our own world.
Very good. Well, thanks for coming on again, Naveen.
Thanks for having me.